I could hear Grandma rocking back and forth in her chair, singing hymns that must have given her the strength to stay alert all night. That night, in my diary, I wrote to God, "Maybe going to Central High isn't such a good idea after all. It is costing my family a lot of agony and energy, and I haven't even attended one day yet. Will Grandma always have to sit up guarding us? She can't go on sitting there forever. What will become of us? Maybe I should start my plan for moving to Cincinnati. Please, give me some sign of what I am to do." Late Monday evening, the shrill ring of the phone awakened me. Mother took the call from the NAACP, telling us not to attend school the next day, Tuesday. We were to wait until we were notified before going to Central. Early the next morning, I caught Grandmother nodding at her guard post as I went out to pick up the newspaper. The headlines told the story. Faubus calls National Guard to keep schools segregated. Troops take over at Central High. Negroes told to wait. Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, September 3rd, 1957. I wondered why some news reports said Faubus called the troops to keep us away from school. He had said in his speech they weren't there to enforce segregation. Nevertheless, the word came once more that under no circumstances were we to go near Central High. The governor had officially forbidden us to go to Central, and whites were forbidden to go to Horace Mann, our school. Both places were officially off limits. At breakfast, Grandma India said she couldn't for the life of her figure out why he'd make our school off limits to whites, but it was an intriguing thing to do. I could see the relief in her weary face when we knew I wouldn't be going to school. She said it was a perfectly good idea to pause and take stock. We were in no rush to get into that school. So all day Tuesday, we did just that. We took stock. Lots of people in our community figured they should get a word in, and they did, by telephone and in person. A few even had the nerve to drop over without calling to give us their opinions. My father dropped by and caused quite an uproar. He stormed into the house demanding that I stay away from Central because his boss was threatening to take his job away. Grandma India quieted him. "Maybe our children getting a good education is much more important than your job." He rolled his eyes at her, but left after that. On the way out, he was shouting he'd be back to take me away from Mother Lois if there was any trouble. I guess Grandma saw I had hurt feelings because she put her arms around my shoulders and said, "I figure the vote is running half and half, but you're in luck. God's voting on your side. So march forward, girl, and don't look back." Tuesday afternoon, school superintendent Virgil Blossom called a meeting of the 9 of us students and our folks. During that meeting, the tall, stocky, grim-faced Blossom breathlessly instructed our parents not to come with us to school the next day. "It will be easier to protect the children if adults aren't there," he said. The looks on the faces of the adults told me they all were frightened. Not one among them seemed certain of what they were doing. As we arrived home, the man on the radio explained Federal Judge Ronald Davies' ruling, ordering integrated classes to begin on Wednesday. The phone was ringing off the hook. Our minister said some of the church members were forming a group made up of people from several churches. They would pray and work for peace in the city. At the same time, he said, they would be ready to help us if we needed it. The call just after midnight from the NAACP didn't really disturb us because we were already receiving a series of late-night calls from segregationists who were loud and vulgar in their views. Mrs. Bates said we would meet at 12th and Park. The school was between 14th and 16th on Park. Perhaps we would be accompanied by several ministers. Some of them would be white. She named Reverend Dunbar Ogden, Jr., the white president of the Interracial Ministerial Alliance, and two of our ministers, Reverend Z.Z. Driver of the African Methodist Episcopal Church and Reverend Harry Bass of the Methodist Episcopal Church. By Wednesday morning, September 4th, I could hardly believe it was really happening. I was going to Central High School. As I prepared breakfast before leaving home on that first morning, Grandmother India stood over my shoulder watching while I cracked the breakfast eggs for poaching. Every radio in the house was tuned to the stations that gave frequent news reports. The urgent voices grabbed our attention whether we wanted them to or not. I'd never heard the news read that often, except when there was a tornado. Hundreds of Little Rock citizens are gathered in front of Central High School, awaiting the arrival of the Negro children. We're told people have come from as far away as Mississippi, Louisiana, and Georgia to join forces to halt integration. Governor Faubus continues to predict that blood will run in the streets if Negroes force integration in this peaceful capital city of just over 100,000 citizens. Grandma India said, seeing as how Federal Judge Davies had ruled for integration, the governor was forced to listen. She was certain Governor Faubus was a God-fearing man who would not defy federal law. I smiled in agreement, nodding my head, but I wasn't as confident as she was that Governor Faubus was going to follow the rules. She always saw the good in everybody. It made me feel so proud when people said I behaved and looked like her. There were happy lines around her mouth that made her face always appear as though she were about to break into a sweet smile, even when her words told me she was displeased with my behavior. "You're not gonna let white people make you nervous, are you? They're the same as us, God's children." It's not only being with the whites. Central isn't just any school, you know, Grandma. I wondered what it would be like to attend school inside that gigantic brick building that looks so much like a big Eastern university. Rumor had it that Central students enjoyed several fancy kitchens set up just for home economics class, as well as the latest projectors for showing movies and all sorts of science laboratory equipment. The newspaper said it had the highest ranking given by the North Central Association of Colleges and Secondary Schools. I had read that two of its graduates had become Rhodes Scholars. The building was 7 stories high, stretching along 2 extra long city blocks. It must have been 8 times the size of Horace Mann, my old high school. It was surrounded by manicured lawns and trees, with a pond in front. It had the kind of look I had only seen in movies, the kind that tells you folks had budgeted lots of money to keep things nice. Grandma reassured me that although Central High was a special place, I deserved to be there as much as anyone. She said I would not have been chosen if school officials didn't think I could measure up to the coursework. But there were lots of my own people giving me the kind of advice that made me think they didn't have faith in me. They didn't think my brain or my manners were good enough to be with white people. My friend, Marcia, for one. She had lectured me on the evils of perspiration. She said white people didn't perspire, so I had to be certain I didn't let them see me perspire. I was petrified on that first morning I was to go to school, because standing over the kitchen stove, helping Grandma with breakfast, was making me perspire. I was also afraid of ruining the blouse Mother Lois had sewn for me to wear. But Grandma consoled me by saying there was nothing wrong with perspiration. No matter what, I had to be myself, she chided. I shouldn't ever change myself to try and become like the white people. The ring of the phone jarred us both. The furrow in Grandma's brow showed her annoyance. Nevertheless, she padded down the hall to answer once more. The heckler should be tired by now, I thought. After all, they had been up all night calling me. God hears you talking this way, Grandma shouted into the receiver before she slammed it down. Charging back to the kitchen, she was wearing a pretend smile so I wouldn't know how upset she was. I busied myself basting the eggs, hoping she wouldn't see I'd overcooked them. There was a long silence before either of us spoke. I said that maybe we ought to change our phone number, but Grandma said she wouldn't give them the satisfaction. Pulling out the special pocket watch given her by Grandpa, who had been a railroad man, she paused for a moment to be certain of the time. It was on time to the tenth of a second. She directed me to pay attention to what I was doing, reminding me that I was supposed to meet the others at 8. The last thing I wanted was to face the 1,950 white students at Central High all by myself. That was 3 times as many students as attended Horace Mann. "Don't look 'em in the eye, sis," my younger brother Conrad said. Tossing his satchel on the table, he continued. "Remember what happened to Emmett Till?" His expression changed as his eyes lit up with monstrous delight. I thought about Mr. Till, who had been hanged and tossed in the Mississippi River because he looked white folks in the eye. Grandma must have noticed how upset I was getting because she said that was in Mississippi and Little Rock's white people were more civilized. She grabbed Conrad and chastised him for not being more loving when I most needed it. When Mother Lois entered the room smiling her good mornings, I noticed she seemed deep in her own thoughts. I couldn't help thinking if I were as beautiful as she, I'd be a real hit at Central High. Grandma took my hand as she started the blessing, asking the Lord to protect me. I closed my eyes, but not even the breakfast blessing could halt the thoughts buzzing through my mind. As we ate, I hoped no one noticed that I pushed my food about my plate because my stomach didn't want breakfast. Mother spoke my name softly, and I looked up at her. "You don't have to integrate this school. Your grandmother and I will love you no matter what you decide. But I have no choice if we're going to stay in Little Rock," I said. I couldn't stop hoping that integrating Central High School was the first step to making Little Rock just like Cincinnati, Ohio. Besides, we had been told students of Little Rock's richest and most important white families attended there. They were also probably very smart. As soon as those students got to know us, I had total faith they would realize how wrong they had been about our people. "A lot has changed in the 2 years since you signed up to go to Central. You were younger then," Mother said with a frown on her face. "Maybe it was a hasty decision, a decision we'll all regret." "I have to go," I said. "I've given my word to the others. They'll be waiting for me. You have my permission to change your mind at any time. This has got to be your decision. No one can go into that school each day for you. You're on your own." Before Mama Lois could say another word, the phone rang. Conrad raced to answer, but Mother was there first. "Keep your seat, young man." As she held the phone to her ear, she stood motionless and silent, and her face grew ashen and drawn. Then she slowly replaced the receiver in its cradle and said, "It's time to go. 5. Judge Orders Integration, Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, September 3, 1957. Dear Diary, it's happening today. What I'm afraid of most is that they won't like me and integration won't work and Little Rock won't become like Cincinnati, Ohio. As we walked down the front steps, Mother paused and turned to look back at Grandma, who was standing at the edge of the porch. In their glance, I saw the fear they had never voiced in front of me. Grandma lingered for a moment and then rushed to encircle me in her arms once more. God is always with you, she whispered as she blinked back tears. Trailing behind Mother, I made my way down the concrete path as she climbed into the driver's seat behind the wheel of our green Pontiac. I don't know why I veered off the sidewalk, taking the shortcut through the wet grass that would make damp stains on my saddle shoes. Perhaps I wanted some reason not to go to the integration. I knew if Grandma noticed, she would force me to go back and polish my shoes all over again. But she was so preoccupied, she didn't say a word. As I climbed into the passenger seat, I looked back to see her leaning against the porch column, her face weary, her eyes filled with tears. Mother pressed the gas pedal, and we gained speed. I always watched closely because I wanted my license by my 16th birthday, only 3 months away. I knew the process well by now. She had guided me through practice sessions in the parking lot next to the grocery store often enough. We moved through the streets in silence, listening to the newsmen's descriptions of the crowds gathering at Central High. I noticed some of our neighbors standing on the sidewalk, many more than were usually out this time of day. That's strange, Mama mumbled as she waved to people who didn't bother waving back. No matter, maybe they didn't see me. Our neighbors had always been so friendly, but now they peered at us without their usual smiles. Then I saw Kathy and Rhonda, two of my school friends, standing with their mothers. Anxious to catch their attention, I waved out the window with a loud, "Hi!" Their disapproving glances matched those of the adults. I didn't do anything to them, I said, not understanding their reason. Then you don't have anything to be concerned about. Mother Lois maneuvered through the unusually heavy traffic. I don't know where all the cars could have come from, she said. We both craned our necks, curious about all the unfamiliar cars and people. Certainly, there had never before been so many white people driving down the streets of our quiet, tree-lined neighborhood. The voice on the radio grew more urgent as the announcer described the ranks of Arkansas National Guardsmen who ringed Central High School. Hearing the news as we drove near our destination, Mother said, I think I'll park here. The meeting place is quite a ways away, but from the looks of things, we won't get any closer. The announcer said it was 7:55 as Mama squeezed into a parking space and we settled ourselves quietly for a moment, trying to identify the buzzing noise that seemed as if it were all around us. It resembled the sound of crowds at my high school football games. But how could that be? The announcer said there was a crowd, but surely it couldn't be that big. Well, I guess we'd better get going. Mother was squinting, cupping her hands over her eyes to protect them against the glare of sunlight. A stream of white people were hurrying past us in the direction of Central High, so many that some had to walk on the grass and in the street. We stepped out of the car and into their strange parade, walking in silence in the midst of their whispers and glares. Anxious to see the familiar faces of our friends or some of our own people, we hurried up the block lined with wood frame houses and screened-in porches. I strained to see what lay ahead of us. In the distance, large crowds of white people were lining the curb directly across from the front of Central High. As we approached behind them, we could see only the clusters of white people that stretched for a distance of 2 blocks along the entire span of the school building. My mind could take in the sights and sounds only one by one. Flashing cameras, voices shouting in my ears, men and women jostling each other, old people, young people, people running, uniformed police officers walking, men standing still, men and women waving their fists, and then the long line of uniformed soldiers carrying weapons, just like in the war movies I had seen. Everyone's attention seemed riveted on the center of the line of soldiers, where a big commotion was taking place. At first, we couldn't see what they were looking at. People were shouting and pointing, and the noise hurt my ears and muffled the words. We couldn't understand what they were saying. As we drew near, the angry outbursts became even more intense, and we began to hear their words more clearly. "Niggers, go home! Niggers, go back where you belong!" I stood motionless, stunned by the hurtful words. I searched for something to hang on to, something familiar that would comfort me or make sense, but there was nothing. 2, 4, 6, 8, we ain't gonna integrate. Over and over, the words rang out. The terrifying frenzy of the crowd was building like steam in an erupting volcano. "We have to find the others," Mama yelled in my ear. "We'll be safer with the group." She grabbed my arm to pull me forward, out of my trance. The look on her face mirrored the terror I felt. Some of the white men and women standing around us seemed to be observing anxiously. Others, with angry faces and wide-open mouths, were screaming their rage. Their words were becoming increasingly vile, fueled by whatever was happening directly in front of the school. The sun beat down on our heads as we made our way through the crowd searching for our friends. Most people ignored us, jostling each other and craning their necks to see whatever was at the center of the furor. Finally, we got closer to the hub of activity. Standing on our toes, we stretched as tall as we could to see what everyone was watching. "Oh, my Lord," Mother said. It was my friend Elizabeth they were watching. The anger of that huge crowd was directed toward Elizabeth Eckford as she stood alone in front of Central High, facing the long line of soldiers, with a huge crowd of white people screeching at her back. Barely 5 feet tall, Elizabeth cradled her books in her arms as she desperately searched for the right place to enter. Soldiers in uniforms and helmets, cradling their rifles, towered over her. Slowly, she walked first to one and then another opening in their line. Each time she approached, the soldiers closed ranks, shutting her out. As she turned toward us, her eyes hidden by dark glasses, we could see how erect and proud she stood, despite the fear she must have been feeling. As Elizabeth walked along the line of guardsmen, they did nothing to protect her from her stalkers. When a crowd of 50 or more closed in like diving vultures, the soldiers stared straight ahead as if posing for a photograph. Once more, Elizabeth stood still, stunned, not knowing what to do. The people surrounding us shouted, stomped, and whistled as though her awful predicament were a triumph for them. I wanted to help her, but the human wall in front of us would not be moved. We could only wedge through partway. Finally, we realized our efforts were futile. We could only pray as we watched her struggle to survive. People began to applaud and shout, "Get her! Get the nigger out of here! Hang her black ass!" Not one of those white adults attempted to rescue Elizabeth. The hulking soldiers continued to observe her peril, like spectators enjoying a sport. Under siege, Elizabeth slowly made her way toward the bench at the bus stop. Looking straight ahead as she walked, she did not acknowledge the people yelping at her heels like mad dogs. Mother and I looked at one another, suddenly conscious that we, too, were trapped by a violent mob. Ever so slowly, we eased our way backward through the crowd, being careful not to attract attention. But a white man clawed at me, grabbing my sleeve and yelling, "We got us a nigger right here." Just then, another man tugged at his arm, distracting him. Somehow, I managed to scramble away. As a commotion began building around us, Mother took my arm and we moved fast, sometimes crouching to avoid attracting more attention. We gained some distance from the center of the crowd and made our way down the block. But when I looked back, I saw a man following us, yelling, "They're getting away! Those niggas are getting away!" Pointing to us, he enlisted others to join him. Now, we were being chased by four men, and their number was growing. We scurried down the sidewalk, bumping into people. Most of the crowd was still preoccupied watching Elizabeth. Panic-stricken, I wanted to shout for help, but I knew it would do no good. Policemen stood by watching Elizabeth being accosted. Why would they help us? "Melba, take these keys," Mother commanded as she tossed them at me. "Get to the car. Leave without me if you have to." I plucked the car keys from the air. "No, Mama, I won't go without you." Suddenly, I felt the sting of her hand as it struck the side of my face. She had never slapped me before. "Do what I say," she shouted. Still, I knew I couldn't leave her there. I reached back to take her arm. Her pace was slowing, and I tried to pull her forward. The men were gaining on us. If we yelled for help or made any fuss, others might join our attackers. Running faster, I felt myself begin to wear out. I didn't have enough breath to keep moving so fast. My knees hurt, my calves were aching, but the car was just around the next corner. The men chasing us were joined by another carrying a rope. At times, our pursuers were so close I could look back and see the anger in their eyes. Mama's pace slowed, and one man came close enough to touch her. He grabbed for her arm but instead tugged at her blouse. The fabric ripped, and he fell backward. Mama stepped out of her high-heeled shoes, leaving them behind, her pace quickening in stocking feet. One of the men closest to me swung at me with a large tree branch but missed. I felt even more panic rise up in my throat. If he hit me hard enough to knock me over, I would be at his mercy. I could hear Grandma India's voice saying, "God is always with you, even when things seem awful." I felt a surge of strength and a new wind. As I turned the corner, our car came into sight. I ran hard, faster than ever before, unlocked the door, and jumped in. Mother was struggling, barely able to keep ahead of her attackers. I could see them turning the corner close on her heels, moving fast toward us. I swung open the passenger door for Mother and revved the engine. Barely waiting for her to shut the door, I shoved the gear shift into reverse and back down the street with more speed than I'd ever driven forward. I slowed to back around the corner. One of the men caught up and pounded his fist on the hood of our car while another threw a brick at the windshield. Turning left, we gained speed as we drove through a hail of shouts and stones and glaring faces. But I knew I would make it because the car was moving fast and Mama was with me. 6. We sped away from Central High School's neighborhood and into more familiar streets where we should have felt safe. Mother directed me not to drive straight home, but to circle around until we knew for certain that the men from the mob weren't chasing us. Even though I didn't have a license and had only practiced driving in the parking lot, she wouldn't allow me to stop so we could switch places. Her face was drained and her eyes haunted by a kind of fear I had not seen in her before. Again and again, she urged me to keep moving while she frantically searched the radio dial for word of Elizabeth. We tried desperately to think of whom we could call to rescue her. We couldn't call the police. We couldn't call her parents. They didn't have a telephone. And Mrs. Bates and the NAACP folks were at Central High waiting with my friends. As I drove, I couldn't help noticing that the streets were clogged with cars and people that did not belong in our neighborhood. There were dust-covered trucks full of tobacco-chewing white men, their naked arms and shoulders sporting tattoos. When we pulled into our backyard, Grandmother India was waiting for us with an anxious expression. "Thank God you made it home," she gasped. "What about Elizabeth and the others? Have you heard anything?" "Yes, yes, but let's get inside. We've got to call the ministers at the church," Mother said, scrambling up the back stairs. "Morning," hollered our next-door neighbor, Mrs. Conyers, over the backyard fence. "Morning, child. I heard about you on the radio. I think you all better back off them white people and stay home before we all get hurt." "Hurry, child. Hurry." Grandma India ushered us through the back door. In her face, I saw reason to be even more frightened. There were no smiles, only a furrowed brow and terrified eyes. As we entered the house, I saw that she had locked all the doors and windows and pulled all of the shades. As soon as we were safely inside, she piled chairs against the locked back door. "So what about Elizabeth?" I said. "I think she's safe. A white woman and man sat with her on the bus bench, protecting her from those awful people clawing at her. Then they got on the bus with her and rode away. So she's okay." "That's a real miracle," Mother said. "And the others, Terry and Ernie and those guys?" "The soldiers turned them away from that school, just like they did Elizabeth. They're safe. They didn't catch as much trouble because they were in a large group with Mrs. Bates and some of those ministers. But still, they didn't have no Sunday picnic. They had to get out of there real fast." Even though Mother looked exhausted, nothing would do for her but to get dressed and go to work. "We've got to lead as normal a life as possible," she argued as we described to Grandma what had happened to us. "One report said those troops were armed with rifles, nightsticks, and bayonets. Did you see any of that, Melba?"
Yes, ma'am. I think I saw guns."
"Maybe things got mixed up. Perhaps the governor had them there to keep peace, and they mixed up their orders," Grandma mused. "Seems to me they had ample opportunity to keep peace by protecting Elizabeth." Mother Lois sounded very angry. "I think this situation is different than what we bargained for. We'd better let things cool off a bit. You can go back to Horace Mann for now." Grandma squared her shoulders and said, "I don't see how that will solve anything. Pretty soon, white folks will think it's as okay to enslave us as it is to use soldiers to keep our kids out of school." Mother stood in silence, pondering Grandma's words for a long moment. Her expression reflected the painful realization that maybe what Grandma said was true. And then suddenly she said, "I had almost forgotten. I have to speak to you, Melba, and I want you to listen closely to every word and obey. Under no circumstances must you ever mention to anyone what happened to us this morning. Even if you have to tell a white lie and say we didn't go to Central. We have to keep this our secret." Telling a white lie was something she'd never before given me permission to do. She swore me to absolute silence, saying above all else, those men must not connect us with their ugly deed. If we told the story and they found out who they were chasing, they might come after us to finish the job. As she spoke, her voice quivered and her hands shook. I had never seen her so uncontrollable. She looked the way I felt, battered and weary. Finally, she instructed, "Melba, don't you dare go outside, girl. I want to know where you are every moment." She pulled on her jacket, peeked through the glass in the front door, then hurried out onto the porch, almost running around the house to the car. I resigned myself to the fact that Grandma wouldn't allow me to visit Thelma or Minnie Jean or any other friends who lived nearby. I wanted to call them for more news of what happened to them, but before I could pick up the receiver, the phone began to ring off the hook. "Don't you dare answer!" Grandma shouted to me from the kitchen. I plopped down at the dining room table and watched her hop up and down for what seemed like 1,000 times to answer the phone. It didn't stop all morning. First, it was a call from the NAACP, then the ministers. There were our frightened neighbors and friends who said they really cared about me, but insisted they have answers to a string of their nosy questions. And then there were more hecklers threatening death. Our family minister called and promised to send menfolk to protect us. Grandma said one of the would-be protectors had already phoned, saying he wasn't certain whether he wanted to be seen at our house at the cost of endangering his own family and job. By noon, I was saturated with all the news reports and anxious to have some word from the others. I felt restless, trapped. I had helped Grandma with all the chores she'd allow, and I offered to help her with those she insisted she'd do alone. I had played all my Nat King Cole and Johnny Mathis records for romantic daydreaming. I had read through the latest issue of 17 magazine and sneaked through the pages of my secret copy of True Romance. I was so bored, I thought I'd keel over. "I think I want to go back to Horace Mann," I told my grandmother. "At least I'll have assignments and friends and all sorts of wonderful first school day things to do." "One little setback, and you worn out," she said. "No, you're not a quitter." In my diary, I wrote, "I was disappointed not to see what is inside Central High School. I don't understand why the governor sent grown-up soldiers to keep us out. I don't know if I should go back. But Grandma is right. If I don't go back, they will think they have won. They will think they can use soldiers to frighten us, and we'll always have to obey them. They'll always be in charge if I don't go back to Central and make the integration happen." By late afternoon, the ringing phone, the hot weather, and my confinement were driving me nuts. So when the phone rang, I grabbed for it. "Where were you?" I could hear annoyance in Minnie Jean's voice. "I was there," I said. "Across the street. I saw Elizabeth being chased by those ugly people. Why was she alone?" "Remember, she doesn't have a phone, so she didn't get that midnight call. She didn't know where or when to meet us." "Mama and I barely made it out of there," I said, being cautious not to tell all. "We got out of there as fast as we could. First we went to the superintendent's office. We waited there for an hour, sitting on those hard benches. Then Mrs. Bates dragged us on to the United States Attorney's office to see a Mr. Cobb." "Why?" "She said since Judge Davies made a federal order, we should go there. But Cobb sent us on to the FBI office. That was kind of secret and fun. Those guys look just the way they do on television, like they know something, but they won't tell." "Yeah, but what did they do?" "Asked a lot of questions and wrote the answers down."
"Questions?"
"Yeah, all about where we stood and who did what to us. Took hours, and I was sweating so bad I thought I would die."
"Well, are they going to do anything?"
"Investigate. They said they'd investigate."
"Sure. By that time, we could be dead."
"You ain't kidding.
That mob was outright nasty. I gotta go now, but can you meet me in 15 minutes and we'll go to the community center?
The community center?
I whispered. It seemed like forever since I had an ordinary afternoon there, listening to records and talking to friends who didn't use the word integration. I thought about the wonderful times Minnie Jean and I had shared, times when our greatest concern was saving enough allowance to buy a new record or praying to be asked to walk to the cafeteria with the right boy. Maybe our lives could be that way again. I tiptoed past Grandma, peacefully snoozing in her rocking chair. Suddenly, she was awake.
"Just where do you think you're going, Missy?"
To the community center? I didn't want to disturb you. I thought you were sleeping.
Uh-huh. Have a seat. The best you can do is let up a window, but you ain't going to no community center.
I couldn't stop the rush of tears. I ran to my room and fell onto the bed, burying my face in the pillow to hide the sobs that wrenched my insides. All my disappointment over not getting into Central High and the mob chase, as well as the big sudden changes in my life over the past few weeks, came crashing in on me. Then I heard Grandma India padding across the room and felt the weight of her body shift the plane of the mattress as she sat down.
"You had a good cry, girl."
Her voice was sympathetic, but also one sliver away from being angry.
"Yes, ma'am."
"You'll make this your last cry. You're a warrior on the battlefield for your Lord. God's warriors don't cry, 'cause they trust that he's always by their side. The women of this family don't break down in the face of trouble. We act with courage, and with God's help, we ship trouble right on out."
"But I tried to explain.
"But nothing. Now, you get yourself together. Read the 23rd Psalm and don't ever let me see you behave this way again."
"Yes, ma'am."
The anger in her voice hurt my feelings, but her warm hand patted my arm to reassure me of her love. From then on, I knew I could only cry when no one would hear me. I became very anxious as I watched the curtain of dusk shadow the sun. Although I relished the protective veil of night, I feared the men who had chased us earlier might use the cover of darkness to hurt us. For much of the early evening, my family hovered in the living room, reading newspapers, listening to the radio, and watching the news. There were the ever-present phone calls to frighten us. Sometimes they even entertained us, as when we heard Grandma give them her call to worship, reading Bible verses, and asking them if they had found the Lord.
"Whew, that was quite a workout," she said,
fanning herself with a folded newspaper and settling down into her favorite chair.
"White ministers have their work cut out for them."
Turning away from the television, Mother said,
"Yeah, but I'm not certain those ministers will get their work done before we're driven out of our minds by the phone calls. I think we'll have to get another telephone number. We can't go on this way."
"Give it a few more days," Grandma said. "Surely, surely they'll get tired and go away."
You know the effort they made to integrate over in North Little Rock failed dismally, Mother Lois said. She went on to explain to us how the attempt to integrate North Little Rock's white high school had also been met with a violent and angry crowd. And then she told us of a frightening talk she had had with one of the administrators at the school where she taught 7th grade English. He started the conversation innocently enough, but then he asked me why I would subject my daughter to being the first to integrate. I told him if nobody takes responsibility for being the first, it will never get done. On and on he went,
asking questions and describing the worst possible outcomes. Then he warned that some North Little Rock white school officials might take it personally that I allowed Melba to go to Central. I think this might be a time when we have to keep our business close to our chests, Mother cautioned. I didn't give him any details of our encounter this morning. He asked me point blank if I would take you out of school, and I said we'd have to see how things worked out. Sounds as though they are threatening you a little. Grandma's face showed anguish as she spoke. The thought of Mother not having that teaching job upset me. Before she was hired, we had little food on the table, and Grandma had to make most of my dresses from bleached flour sacks. Mother had worked so hard for it. Besides, she was now our sole support. Daddy gave us money only now and then. I decided I had to change the thoughts running through my mind. They frightened me too much. I was ready to see something other than integration on the news, so I began flipping channels, looking for Lucy, Sid Caesar, or the hit parade. Just then, Grandma India raised the newspaper to show me headlines. Ring of troops block integration here. No incidents reported. Officials huddle. The article said that the Arkansas National Guardsmen were indeed armed with rifles, bayonets, and nightsticks to keep us out of the school, and that troopers from the Arkansas State Police had joined them. The official total was 270 guards posted to fend us off, but folks who had driven around the school said it was more like 500. I took heart from another headline. Ike orders Brownell to look into Farber's act. Then I spotted another story farther down the page that said, Wiley Branton, legal counsel for the local NAACP, had officially announced that our parents would not allow us to return to school. We breathed a sigh of relief. The question of what I would do the following morning had definitely been settled. Our usual household routine was stalled, however, as we dealt with threats from callers. No matter how many times we vowed we'd have a normal evening, somehow we always ended up turning back to the news to keep up with what was going on. Radio reports said the crowd gathered outside Central earlier had broken into splinter groups and now roamed the city, terrorizing our people wherever they found them. The news reports were all the same. Gangs of gun-toting renegades are reportedly arriving from surrounding states to join segregationist fight to halt integration. Meanwhile, Governor Farbus continues to predict blood will run in the streets if the federal order to integrate schools is enforced. I don't see why we should allow these silly white people to frighten us into giving up our lives. I'll start dinner and I expect you all to help. Grandma gathered up the paper and headed for the kitchen. The shrill ring of the telephone upset me even more now that I had seen my enemies. I imagined the callers to resemble those men who had chased me. It felt as though they were entering my home each time they called. I could tell Mother felt the same way. With each ring, her expression turned grimmer. I'll get it. Conrad's voice was less enthusiastic than usual, but still he made his chase for the phone until he was ordered to halt. Grandma had interrupted her cooking to hurry to the phone. She called to me from the hallway.
Sounds like maybe that boy Vince, you know, the polite one from church that we usually see at the wrestling matches.
Grandma beckoned me to take the receiver. Vince. I thought to myself as my heart leaped with joy. Sure, I knew very well who Vince was. He attended high school in a neighboring town, but he was in my Sunday school class. It was Grandma who didn't really know that Vince was my secret pretend dreamboat boyfriend. I wasn't at all certain he knew it. He was at least 2 years older than me and drove a new Chevy and looked sort of like a caramel-colored James Darren.
Make this conversation brief, honey,
Grandma said as she handed me the phone.
Hello,
I said, using the sexy whisper dictated by romance magazines.
Melba?
It wasn't Vince's voice saying my name.
Yes,
I answered in a polite tone, dropping my pretense. The voice wasn't at all familiar to me.
Melba, nigga, I know where you live. 12th and Cross. We gonna get you tonight, long about midnight.
I heard the receiver click, and he was gone. Did he know where my bedroom was? Would he come over now? Did he have a bomb? I couldn't tell Mama and the others that he knew so much about us, so I choked back my tears. As I entered the living room, faces turned my way in anticipation. I pretended a smile and said it was somebody else, another friend, not Vince. I thought it was a sign that we were feeling more confident when we turned the television set off right in the middle of all the uproar about Central and took our places at the dinner table. After the blessing, the topic turned to what was really on our minds.
I'll keep watch again tonight. If I need you, I'll call you,
Grandma said. I could tell Mother was deep in thought. She studied her plate for a long moment before she looked up at Grandma and said,
Maybe you could get some sleep tonight, and I could stand guard.
That would be a real good idea, except you don't know how to shoot a gun. This is no time for on-the-job training.
Grandma was an expert marksman. As a railroad man, Grandpa had spent lots of time away from home. He had insisted Grandma learn to use a gun to protect herself because they had lived in an isolated area in the early years of their marriage.
May I have on-the-job training?
Conrad asked.
Not with this job, you can't. God does not forgive those who kill others,
Grandma said.
Expert marksmanship is a must because you always got to aim for fingers or toes and them's small targets.
When the call came from the NAACP saying perhaps we wouldn't be going to school for several days because we'd be in court, we all seemed to relax. But our peace was only for a moment. Later that evening, phone callers told us that the houses of several of our people connected with integration had been attacked. The news reports were revealing our names and addresses. Mother Lois said Conrad couldn't play outside, and she demanded that from now on, he walked to school in the company of several other children. As I stood over the kitchen sink, getting ready to wash the dishes, Grandma went about what for the past few nights she had been calling her security walk. She placed a flashlight by the back door near the stack of chairs that blocked it. Then she took Conrad with her as she double-checked the lock on every door and window in the house. Peering out the window over the sink, I was astonished to see the neighborhood silent, empty, and eerie. Usually, this time of the year, all our windows and doors would stand open, like those of our neighbors. We would go back and forth bearing lemonade, engaged in happy chatter. I could always hear laughter as people gathered on their porches. Sometimes, a gospel group or a blues singer practiced songs for everyone to enjoy. But tonight, it was dead silent. It appeared everyone had locked their windows and doors.
Melba?
Mother Lois walked up behind me, interrupting my thoughts.
Yes, ma'am.
I guess I'd better say this while we're alone and I'm thinking about it. I'm gonna leave a change of clothing hanging outside your bedroom closet door. If somebody ever gets into our house late at night, you grab those clothes, go out the back door, and run as fast as you can down to 9th Street.
But, Mama, why 9th Street? You told me never to go to 9th Street.
It was the roughest area of Little Rock where all the honky-tonks and sinful people gathered.
Yes, but no white person would know you there. Those places stay open late at night and are filled with our people. They'll protect you.
But what about you and Grandma and Conrad? I wouldn't want to leave you.
We'll be fine. You could send the menfolk up here to help us. Do you understand what I'm telling you?
Yes, ma'am. I don't want to frighten you, but we have to take some precautions now.
Mama had a sad look in her eyes, although she feigned a smile as she kissed me. I stood still for a moment, listening to the pounding in my temples. Mama's words really upset me. She must have expected someone to come after me if she was telling me to go to 9th Street. So I decided I could either frighten myself to death by imagining what might happen to me, or I could think about Vince. I started to spin a happy daydream.
Are you deaf, child?
Grandma India was shouting at me from the hall and beckoning me to the phone.
Hello?
So hi. It's me.
It was really Vince this time.
Been hearing about you on the news. Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine.
I wanted to appear nonchalant.
The radio guy said you were being hidden somewhere special to protect you from all the death threats.
Not me. I'm right here. Grandma India was hovering over me, pointing to her watch.
Are you scared? Is anyone there to protect you?
Not really, but we're just fine.
Everybody's talking about you all. We're so proud of what you're doing.
Well, not everybody's proud.
Yeah, sure. Some folks are afraid of losing their jobs. My mama says some of her creditors told her they'd shut her restaurant down if they ever caught her helping with integration.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I hoped he wouldn't be angry with me and stop calling.
Lots of white businesses are threatening to lay off our people, and they're going to squeeze us every way they can, it seems.
What do you want us to do about it?
I couldn't tell what his position was.
Nothing you can do. Mama's church is having a secret meeting to kind of lift folks' spirits and give a little help to those that really need it.
We're not out to hurt anybody. You know that.
Just ignore our people who badmouth you. They got no thoughts about the future. They're waiting for white folks to fix things for them.
I've got to go.
I understand. Miss India's right there next to you, isn't she? See you at the wrestling matches.
I ignored Grandma India's questioning eyes as we headed for the living room to join Mama and Conrad, who were watching TV. I pretended I wasn't absolutely overjoyed that Vince cared whether I would be going to the matches with Grandma on Saturday night. It was the one thing in my life that made me feel normal and happy, the way I did before integration took me over. I settled down into my chair and buried my face in a magazine, refusing to give myself over to television. I wanted to save all of my mind for daydreaming about Vince and me, and how we might actually become real girlfriend and boyfriend. I wanted everybody to know I had a fellow of my own. Suddenly, I heard a loud popping sound, like firecrackers on the 4th of July. Then glass was breaking.
"Get down now!"
Grandma yelled. I fell forward on my knees, looking at the broken glass. The green vase on top of the television set had shattered into 1,000 pieces, spraying slivers all over the walls, the floor, and us. For an instant, we were paralyzed, motionless, like people in a snapshot. Everything after that moment seemed to be happening in slow motion, frame by frame. Before we could move, there was another firecracker noise, and more glass fell to the floor.
"We gotta get the lights out,"
Mama ordered.
Each of us moved to shut off the lights nearest us. My hands were shaking as I crawled over to turn off the television. I heard rustling sounds like somebody moving through the bushes just outside the window. Oh, God, I thought, they're going to come in and shoot all of us, Grandma and Mama and Conrad and me.